Okay, so on Friday I received an email inviting me to write an article on about nirvana. And so it's been a little bit on my mind this weekend, and I thought I would talk a little bit about this very famous topic no one knows anything about. Nirvana. In Pali it's called Nibbana, the way that Pali and Sanskrit kind of are closely connected, but pronounced a little bit differently. So Nibbana. And it's a word that's often used as pointing to the ultimate goal of the Buddhist spiritual life, the goal and the resolution of that life and that practice. And as a way of introducing it, I want to mention a very famous discourse that the Buddha gave called the Fire Sermon. And I read this Fire Sermon as being a really great piece of rhetorical sermoning. And the Buddha says, with great emphasis, I imagine, he says, everything is on fire. Your eyes are on fire. What you see is on fire. How you the perception of sight in your mind is on fire. Everything having to do with sight is on fire. Your nose is on fire. Smells are on fire. Everything has to do with receiving and perceiving smells is on fire. Your tongue is on fire. Tastes are on fire. Everything having to do with taste is on fire. Your ears are on fire. Auditory experiences are on fire. Everything having to do with hearing in the brain, the mind is on fire. And he goes on, kind of this, on fire, it's on fire, it's on fire. It's on fire, everything's on fire. And then he says, it's on fire with greed, hate, and delusion. It's on fire with greed, hate, and delusion. And it doesn't take a lot of looking around at our world to realize, to say, you know, our world is on fire. You know, literally it's not on fire. But the degree to which there is greed, hate, and delusion rampant in our world and you know, causing tremendous suffering and destruction and despair for people. It's just you know, it's just astounding how much is there. So you might say our world is on fire with the forces of greed, hate, and delusion, the results of greed, hate, and delusion that spring from people's minds. And so everything is on fire with greed, hate, and delusion. Nirvana has, the word Nibbana or Nirvana has many different meanings, or different people have different interpretations of the word. In India at the time of the Buddha, there were different, that word existed and people used it in different ways. The Buddha had a particular way of using the word, but one of its colloquial meanings is it means to extinguish a fire, to quench a fire, to cool a fire. So back then lamps had flames. So the extinguishing of the flame of the lamp, in doing that, the lamp would be nibbanized. Or a fire was put out, it would be nibbanized. And it wasn't just simply that it would disappear, the fire. The word nibbana implied that the fire was cooled, and cool in a hot climate is very refreshing. So it was a wonderful state of being cooled, of being quieted, of being settled. And so the state of being, this experience or this thing of nibbana was used by in Buddhism to point to the possibility of quenching or cooling or putting out the fires of greed, hate, and delusion in our minds. And so that's what it refers to, that possibility. So The most common definition of nirvana is the putting to end, putting to stop, or extinguishing the forces of greed, hate, and delusion. Some people might doubt that it's possible to do this, or that it's desirable to do this. But the Buddhist tradition is predicated on the belief or the understanding that it is possible to do this, and that it is really worthwhile to somehow cool the fires of greed, hate, and delusion. Now, in order for a fire to burn, it has to have fuel. And it turns out that in Pali, the language the Buddha spoke, there's a wonderful wordplay, in a sense, because the word for fuel or sustenance that keeps a fire burning is also the same word for clinging, upadana. So again, this use of the imagery of fire, that the very thing that keeps the fire of greed, hatred going is the fuel of that is our clinging, the grasping. And so there's a possibility then of somehow, if you want to cool the fire down, you have to get down to the fuel and somehow put a stop to the clinging, to relax, let go of the clinging, let go far enough so there's no clinging there that can produce greed, hate, and delusion. And the purpose of nirvana, the function of nirvana as a goal, nirvana is in a sense an experience that can happen to people. Meditation, the goal of meditation in the end is nirvana. And so the experience of nirvana, if we can talk about it that way, what it is less important than what it does. It has a function. And nirvana itself is kind of sometimes said to be a transcendent reality, a transcendent realm, transcendent experience. But it might be seen that way. But what's important is not so much the transcendence of it, the transcendent aspect of it, but what's important is the transformative function it has, and that it transforms us, it changes us. And so it's an experience that, you know, if you go into the water, the water changes you. If you put a candle and dip it into the water, it snuffs out the candle. The flame is transformed by that that's put out by that water. So what's important about the nirvana is not necessarily what it is, but how it affects us. And that's important to realize, because when people try to describe what it is or talk about what it is, you can go down endless nuances of philosophical subtlety. Partly because this experience of nirvana is maybe ineffable, maybe cannot be described. So if you try to describe it, you end up with all kinds of problems. So the function of nirvana is how it transforms us. And how it transforms us is that in some way or other it begins to uproot or take out the fuel for greed, hate, and delusion. So that it's not there anymore. And it's said that the experience of nirvana is something that can uproot these things once and for all. It isn't just something that you can just kind of, you know, just, oh, through a certain level of equanimity or spaciousness or openness in meditation, you can see these things and not be caught by them. It's really, these things are not going to rise again. They're not going to happen again. Now, but in order to understand nirvana a little bit, or the tremendous potential that the teachings on nirvana point to, you have to appreciate the tremendous subtlety by which the mind operates, or the great subtlety by which the forces of greed, hate, and delusion that, you know, operate in the mind, clinging operate in the mind. The mind, the word mind in Buddhism, is not a thing. It's not like a fixed thing, like a block of granite, you know, but rather the mind is like the software of a computer. It's quite malleable. You know, you can change the software, you can rewrite it in all kinds of ways. The mind is a series of processes, And so we can talk about an ecology of mind. And all these different systems and processes that make up the mind are operating together in various ways. But generally, the mind is operating in such a way that it's about something. The mind is the conscious mind. The consciousness is our thinking, the kind of mind that we're kind of engaged with and involved with, is often being driven by intentionality or planning or these latent tendencies of greed, hate, and delusion. That the activity of the mind is always almost always about something. So if you're sitting in meditation and you're planning what you're going to do for the rest of today, then the mind is about planning. And it's being driven, in a sense, by the planning. It's involved. It's constructing thoughts, ideas about the future and what you want. If you're remembering a conversation you had yesterday and you're angry about it in some way, then, again, your mind then is about a conversation and about your anger, and you're engaged in this aboutness in the mind. The mind often is about something, or consciousness is flavored or colored by its concerns. And so it's concerned with all kinds of things. So, but often it's intentional. Planning or intention, wanting something, is a big part of what the mind is about. It wants something. And so if you just track and watch a little bit your thinking, for example, just your thoughts, you'll see that your thoughts will often have some kind of desire or intentionality behind them. So what is it that keeps you interested in the kind of thoughts that you have? Are they just kind of idle thoughts that are floating through? Sometimes they can be. But sometimes there's a little bit of a sense of drivenness or drive or engagement with that thinking process. And it's quite humbling, I think, sometimes to watch our thinking and to realize how little control we have over our thinking mind. How you can, that the mind has a mind of its own. It's thinking by itself. It's driven. It's on these tracks and gets involved in these tracks. And you might be able to let go of it for a moment, but then you get involved again. It's like Velcro. It's like this kind of like this pump, pumping out these thoughts of a certain direction. Sometimes we talk about the mind being directional. It's interested in some direction, something. So the mind's about something. And in a sense, the degree to which we, thinking or visualizing, some people visualize more than they think in words, thinking has to do with words, it has to do with sentences, and sentences have subject, objects, and verbs, right? So, most of them. And so, they're about something. There's about a verb and intentionality and wanting and all this. So generally our mind is almost always about something. And the technical way that's talked about in Buddhism is the mind most of the time is involved in constructing things. It's a constructive apparatus, constructing meaning, constructing experiences. And it's very subtle, that constructing apparatus. So if you are walking in the mountain trail, forest trail, and you come across a branch on the trail, but you see it suddenly for a moment, you see it as a snake. The mind has constructed a snake out of the branch. Because the mind, what it does, it kind of takes sensory input and interprets it in some way and constructs it in a certain way. So the mind is constantly involved in constructing much of the way we experience and see the world around us. So you come in here to this meditation hall in the morning, and your constructive activity is very much into play, I imagine. You construct floor and cushions and chairs, and you look at people and men and women, and some people with shawls and some people not, and some people this way and that way, and we find ourselves and discover who we are or what the situation is, and we're kind of constructing some kind of an environment here that's more than just what the environment is before we came. Our history of meditation halls, or lack of it, our history of what it's like to be together with groups in the past, our relationship to people, our dispositions we have towards people, all come into play, and it plays out here. Some people come in here, and their first tendency is, who's a nice person to sit next to? Or where's the most comfortable place to sit? Or where's the safest place to sit? Other people come in here, and they think, they focus on, who is it that I don't want to sit next to? Mm-hmm. Where's the place that I don't want to be? Kind of more operating under aversion. But we're kind of constructing in order to make our plans and intentions, the mind is constructive activity. And what's possible, so generally that's what minds do all the time. And that constructive activity of mind, especially when it's driven by greed, hate, and delusion, is one of the definitions of samsara. Samsara is often considered the opposite of nirvana. So the world is not samsara. We don't want to call the world samsara. Samsara is that constructive activity of wanting, intentionality of the mind. So, since greed, hate, and delusion operates so incredibly subtly in our minds, it takes a very well-trained mind to see it, to see how subtle it can be. So one of the functions of meditation practice in Buddhism is to quiet the mind enough so you start seeing the subtlety by which the mind operates. The subtlety of this, the way the mind is driven, the subtlety of how greed, hate, and delusion are operating, intentionality is operating, wanting something is operating, clinging is operating. And as you see the subtlety of it, then it's possible with time to begin letting go of it, or relax it, or soften it. And as the mind becomes quieter, you get a different kind of perspective on the normal activity of the mind than you would have if you always lived the norm with this normal mind. So so if you if you always lived in excuse me, if you always live in fear, and you spent your whole life living in fear, it never occurred to you that you don't have to live in fear, and then suddenly you come to some place where you realize you don't have to be afraid. It's a whole new thing. And from that place of lack of fear, you look back at your, you know, decades of living with fear and say, oh, that was kind of painful. I didn't realize how painful it was, and I just took it as being kind of normal. But it wasn't so normal, it was kind of a coarser thing. It was kind of a more agitated state to be in. Once at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, where I was teaching, a woman came and said to me, this is the first time in my life where I felt safe someplace. And I don't know where she had grown up or where she lived, but this is the first time she felt safe. And this is a place where we don't lock the doors. You know, you're given a room to sleep in, but there's no lock on the door. And no door locks the outside. And she felt this was the safest place she's ever been. So as the mind can get calmer, some of the things we take for granted and consider normal, we start seeing maybe it's not so normal. I don't have to live that way. I don't have to live with that level of stress or that level of agitation, even though I didn't know that it was unusual. I thought it was normal, in a normal state of mind, you know, kind of until then. So so part of the function of meditation practice in Buddhism is to begin shifting the focus of the mind so the mind is not always about something, is not engaged in wanting something or directed in some direction, directed into the future or the past or fantasy or wanting something, or the mind is not so much involved in constructing things anymore, making things up. One of the things we make up is our sense of self. So, and that's often operating very persistently in people. Some idea of who I am and how I have to defend it or build it up or create it or measure it or judge it, or all this selfing goes on. And unless the mind is really calm and peaceful, you might not have a clue how much your mind is constantly involved in the selfing game. So part of the function of getting calm is you see something that you can't really see so well unless you're calm. It's like having you have a wonderful microscope, wonderful tool, you have a wonderful expensive microscope, and you can really see deeply into the nature of reality of this microscope, but you've never taken the lens cap off, or you never cleaned the lens, you know, so you kind of see, but you kind of see all murkily. So part of what meditation can do is you begin relaxing and calming enough and developing enough concentration enough that the lens cap gets taken off, or the grunge on the lens is cleaned off so you can see much more clearly. So as the constructing activities of the mind quiet down, there's less momentum in the mind. There's less centrifugal force in the mind. The mind is less scattered, going outwards. It's less agitated, less driven. And at some point, it's possible for the mind to stop all its constructing activities. All the constructing activities can just come to a stop. So, making a sense of self, having a sense of self, planning, letting go, wanting, having aversion. And it turns out, as I keep saying, the constructing activity is so subtle that even our sense of having a body, the sense of it, the feeling of it, the experience of it, is also part of the constructing activity of the mind. So even the sense of the body being constructed drops away. So just, actually there can be no sense of the body. And then, and since the mind, a normal mind, is primarily a constructing activity, that's what it is, the sense of our mind drops away because the normal mind is not there, the constructing mind is not there. So nirvana is a dimension of the mind. It's an aspect of the mind. Or of consciousness, perhaps, if you want to say. When the mind has no constructing activities as part of it. So all the constructing activities are put to rest and put to stop. And it's really cool. Since one of the meanings of Nibbana is really, it's cool. It's really cool. And not cool in the American colloquial sense, but cool in the sense of being really kind of a great refreshment. It's considered to be the greatest peace, the most ultimate peace that's possible, is that peace when the constructing activities of the mind have come to a stop. When the constructing activities have come to a stop, it's very hard to describe what that is like, because it's constructing activities which are used to describe. And how do you describe something which is not constructed? So it's very hard to describe what it is. Sometimes the analogy of space is used for it. And in a sense, maybe the unconstructed mind, the consciousness which is unconstructed, is kind of like mental space. Though that seems so vacuous. It seems like, what good is that? But it's like space. To understand the shape of space, like this room has the space in this room has a shape, right? And that shape is defined by the walls, in a sense, right? So it has a shape. Or if you're in a house with many rooms, then maybe the space of the bathroom is defined by the shape of the bathroom. The shape is defined by the walls. But if you take out the walls of the bathroom, then you have a bigger room with the living room, whatever, and then you have a bigger space. But if you take away all the walls, then at some point space doesn't have any shape. Does the universe have shape out there on the outer edges of the universe? I don't know. But imagine that the universe doesn't have an edge. I guess it's supposed to have an edge, right? I don't know what happens out there, but at some point space has no, if there's no walls, if there's no boundaries, then the shape of space cannot be defined. In fact, the shape of space doesn't make any sense to talk about shape when there's no walls, right? So the same thing with the mind, which is not constructed. Mind which is not about something cannot be, it doesn't make sense to talk about it. One of the things, because there's no constructing activities in that mind, it doesn't make any sense to talk about location. That mind has no location. Because the mind has no constructing activities with it, it has no inside or outside. Because inside and outside is a constructing activity. Because there's no constructing activity going on, there is no time in that mind. So sometimes it's called timeless. Because constructing activities arise and pass, they're impermanent, they're inconstant. When there is no constructing activities, that sense of impermanence is stopped. And so it said that the mind which is not being constructed is permanent or is timeless, has some internal quality to it. Sometimes it's said that this mind, is luminous, completely luminous, even though there's no light there. So that's kind of an odd thing to say, contradictory. So a timeless mind, it's also called a deathless sometimes because it doesn't have the nature of dying. It's not something that's going to die. Anything that's constructed, anything that's conditioned, will pass away at some point. That's a fundamental truth of Buddhism, at least. It's that all constructed things, all conditioned things, are impermanent. But since the unconstructed mind is not constructed, it's not going to die. So it's called deathless. So the expression up there on the wall is amata dhatu, is a deathless dimension. And that is pointing to this experience, to this place of nirvana. So it's a very unique kind of experience. Exactly what it is a little bit hard to define then. And again, the point of this is not to have the experience for the experience sake. It's, you know, like the thing is important. It's how it's going to change us and transform us. The way that it's this kind of, it does this uprooting. And it's a phenomenal thing to be able to know that there's that there are different alternative places for the mind to be, or different minds to have. You know, if you only know that it's okay to be afraid, you don't know any other alternatives, you live a very narrow life. If you're only involved in a mind that's about things, some people's lives are all about relationships, about being in a relationship, having a relationship, who's thinking about who and how I should be in relation to other people. It's all about relationships. Or being social. And they never spend, you know, any time in solitude in nature, for example. And then after many, many years of being always in solitude, always social, they go into solitude in the nature, and they're just delighted. They love it. I remember some woman when I was living at the monastery, Tassajara, there were two people who came to the monastery to be students there at the same time. And one was a woman who had raised two children, and she said, I grew up in a family of many kids, and I left my home that I grew up in to get married and have children right away. And so I was always around people and children and all this, you know, social life. And then when my kids got old enough, I came to this monastery deep in the Los Padres National Wilderness. And she said, I've never had so much solitude and freedom in my life. This is phenomenal. The fellow who came at the same time had spent the last something like 25 years living alone in a house in the Sunset District in San Francisco. And he came to this exactly same monastery, exactly the same time. And he said, it's so claustrophobic here. I can't believe all these people here. There's always people here. So, you know, that we often get in a certain mindset. And we think that's the mindset we should be in. And so it's possible to kind of have a different experience. He goes, oh, that mindset is, you know, one way of living, but it's possible to have another mindset. And sometimes going to different cultures is a great gift. A Tibetan teacher, Trungpa, said once, if you can't meditate, travel. So you get a whole different mindset, realize there's other mindsets to have. So the more mindsets you know are possible, the more flexibility you have and the more fluidity perhaps you can have moving between them as is appropriate. So to understand the mindset that is not a set at all, the unconstructed mind, the mind of nirvana, gives a very different perspective on what your life can be about or what your life is about. So if you realize that there's a very wonderful place, luminous, peaceful, very happy place, something that where the mind is not involved in constructive activities, then you realize that there's an alternative to constructing activities. And most people are trying to find their happiness by always constructing it, constructing your life in a particular way to get it all to work out, just one way, some way. So it's a cornucopian revolution in the mind to realize that there's a whole other dimension of the mind, a way of being in the mind, a mindset to have, that's so radically different from the normal way in which we are always operating. So this is called, and this alternative mindset is then called nirvana or nibbana. So it's a form of consciousness, and that's very hard to define. And there's a wonderful analogy for this. It's a little bit different than the space analogy. Is that when light travels through space, vacuous space. So I'm not a physicist, so I don't know how this works. But this is the analogy the Buddha used. It's not a modern one. When it's traveling through space, apparently you don't see it. You only see light when it hits something. So the Buddha said, when the light hits a wall, then you see the light. And you understand that light is there. But if it doesn't hit anything, then it's not there. You know, is it there? It's there, but you know, it's like, how do you define it? How do you understand it? How do you measure it? You have to measure light because it hits something. It's your retina, or it hits some instrument or something. But consciousness, the kind of consciousness which is nirvana, is the kind of consciousness, it's like light, it hasn't hit anything. It just exists, it's there, but it hasn't picked anything up, it's not constructed anything, it's not about anything, hasn't touched a thought, hasn't touched a sensation, hasn't touched a feeling or an emotion. So it's very hard to talk about. Now you could easily say, you know, what good is it? Aside from the fact that it's very refreshing, kind of like a peak experience of a kind, it also is transformative. And exactly how it's transformative, you know, what the mechanism of transformation is, I can't tell you. All of it. But the idea here is that as you begin seeing or experiencing this unconstructed mind, it dislodges some of the foundational constructive building blocks or constructive techniques that the mind is using. And the foundational construction that the mind is built on, often, much of it, has to do with greed, hate, and delusion. So that greed and delusion gets dislodged. And first, it only gets dislodged a little bit. And it gets loosened up. It's like you're starting to break it up. It's like you have this heavy-duty concrete. And you can't get rid of the concrete right away, but first you kind of just take this big sledgehammer to it and you kind of break it up a little bit, cracks. So at first, this experience, for most people, the experience of Nibbana, this unconstructed mind, is like taking like a sledgehammer to this constructed world of greed, hate, and delusion. But then, with repeated experience, with deepening that experience and entering into that world of the unconstructed more and more, it begins to more and more kind of dissolve or soften or let go of these forces of greed, hate, and delusion. Until finally, there's nothing solid in the mind anymore, no concrete left, no greed, hate, and delusion left. And and it said that while there's still greed, hate, and delusion left, someone who has seen or experienced Nibbana is kind of like someone who sees a wonderful pool of water. Someone then who's managed to do the work of really breaking up or dissolving all the greed, forces of greed and delusion in their mind is someone who's plunged into the water. So the instructions that are given is, please, plunge into nirvana. Plunge into it. Plunge into this unconstructed mind. Or let go. Stand there on the diving board and just let go into the water. into the refreshment. So, was that sensible? So, okay, I talked about it. So, I constructed an image, an idea of something which is unconstructed. Sorry about that. Are there any questions you'd like to ask about this? Clarifications? Generally, the mind that most of us are usually experiencing is a constructing activities. It's a processes, mental processes that work together. The mind is a system. It's a process of mentality. What's behind the question?
It seems like a basic aspect of what you're talking about.
So mind is a basic, yes, so the mind that we normally have is a series of processes, mental processes that work together to make us aware, to make us think, to have intentionality, to have, to sense, to feel, all these things. All these things working together is a big process. And most of that process is constructing activities. So that the normal mind that we have drops away in the experience of Nibbana. Some people would say there's no mind there, but generally you only don't have a mind when you die. So the idea is you still have a mind, you still have consciousness, but it's a radically different kind of mind, a radically different kind of consciousness when those constructing activities are not present. And someone who is very closely in touch with the unconstructed mind. Somehow it's really kind of influenced by who they are, or they have a sense that it's ever present or something. Then it's possible that the activity of their mind operates very differently, because it's hard to talk about this, but it's like, normally, the activity of the mind arises out of intentionality, planning, wanting, and all that. And it's said that someone who's deeply embedded in this unconstructed mind, that the what they say, what they do, what comes out of them, is not planned, is not willed in the same way that it would be for someone who's, so it's not constructed in the same way. Just kind of, it's very dangerous to kind of try to describe what it is. And one of the aspects of that is that which arises in a sense out of this unconstructed mind doesn't create any karma. Or that which is influenced, the mind that's been influenced by the unconstructed, well enough to be transformed, so there's no greed, hate, and delusion, will no longer be influenced by karma. No longer create karma. Right way. So that doesn't help with your understanding of defining the mind. And okay. Oh, one more. Here. Charlotte.
So you've been meditating for something like 30 years, and I want to ask this without asking anything personal, but what a chance is there that, how many people have you seen who actually got close to this?
That's a fair question. People I've known personally?
No, it doesn't, you mean not historical people, but
people I know personally, people I've met.
Yeah.
People I've met. How many people have I met who have had a taste of Nirvana that I know for sure? Well, I had to think about it for a while, but I could probably pretty quickly rattle off a list of maybe a couple of dozen people.
taste.
What?
taste of it. Is that?
Well, I don't know anybody who's plunged all the way. Like, you know, because that plunged all the way is an arhat, someone who's fully enlightened, fully liberated. And they're reputed such people in Thailand, people around. And so it's possible I met them or something, there's people who are reputed to be in Thailand, Mahabua, for example. There's a variety of people in Thailand who are supposed to be arhats. And I never met them, so I can't say. So, until I got this request to write an article about nirvana, I was going to talk about fear today. Because partly out of last week's conversation. And many years ago, I gave a talk someplace in San Jose, and I showed up and said, I'm going to talk about enlightenment today. But before I do, does anybody have any questions? And we spent the whole evening talking about anger. That was more relevant, right, for people, I guess. So hopefully this was, useful in some way for you, and if not, then so be it. If it wasn't useful, then don't construct anything. Just let it be.